This is based around Genesis chapter 37, verses 1 to 28. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. You might remember that Israel is the name that was given to Jacob after he struggled with a stranger one night on his way back home to be reconciled with his family. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his other brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him.
My son Joseph, the eldest of my dearest Rachel, every time I look at him I remember her. Why shouldn't I favour him, what with his mother dying when little Benjamin was born? Didn't my mother favour me? What harm is in that?
It isn't right, you know. We are every bit as much Jacob's sons as this upstart Joseph. Before he came along, all was well. But then Dad decided to pamper him to the point where we'd be working in the fields, while he stayed back at home, dreaming, currying favour, even getting special clothes. Maddening.
I can't help it that Father loved me more, any more than I can help the dreams God gives me. And I do love this robe Father gave me. I've always had an eye for fine things.
Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing their flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him.
Sometimes Joseph did have a way of getting out of the chores. Maybe I did spoil him a bit, but no matter. It's time he helped his brothers with the work. That's why I sent him out to find them. They need more time together to bond.
This was the final straw. First, Joseph never works with us. Just tells us about his dreams that always end up with him in charge. Then he comes out wearing that ridiculous robe, no doubt coming to check on us and report back to our father whatever slacking he might see. No more. This is the last time.
It was a rather long journey to find my brothers, and because it had been a while since I'd been in the fields, I did lose my way. But luckily that stranger helped me, and I can find them now. And did I tell you how much I love this robe?
They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it.
I wonder what's taking Joseph so long. I miss my child already.
Much as he deserved it, we did relent. Killing was out. Just stick him in that deep pit and let him taste the thirst of water, like we've thirsted for our father's attentions ever since he came along. Oh yes, the robe. We took it. Let's see him get along without his precious robe.
Where am I? I can't see anyone. Can anyone hear me? And where is my robe? Where is my father?
Then they sat down to eat, and looking up they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels carrying gum, balm and rosin, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt.
It has been too long. Joseph should have returned. Will my other sons help him?
It's not right to end Joseph's life, but there's no wrong in taking a bit of profit for the trouble of ridding our family of this troublemaker. He's out of our hands now.
Where are you taking me? Where is my robe? And where are my brothers?
The next reading comes from Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 to 33. Jesus walks on the water. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountains by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but by this time the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning he came walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come out to you on the water." And he said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened and began to sink. He cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You have little faith. Why do you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God."
I really like living where I live now. It's a wonderful place to live. Lying in his bed one morning a bit late, Kim was woken by the strange sounds. And when we looked out the window at the tree in next door's yard, there was a koala in the tree. I've seen koalas walking down the road not far from where we live. And we can walk into Morialta in 5 minutes. Other days when we've driven to Linear Park, not far from where Rhonda lives, and we've walked along there, we've seen kangaroos, and I've even seen an echidna. It's a really lovely place to live. But, and you knew there was a but, didn't you? You knew there was a but coming. But I do miss the sea. Where we used to live at Hacken West, we were about 5 kilometres from the sea. And our kitchen window and back veranda looked out over to the sea. It was a lovely view. For those that did the dishes, it was, you know, a lovely view. That is, in fact, the window at which I threw the plate that I told you about the other day. It is a lovely view. And I mean, what was really good is when the storms used to come in, you could see them coming in over the sea and across the land in between. Usually, if you saw it at the right moment, it gave you enough time to race out and grab the washing off the line before the storm came in. And when it did come, even though we had a veranda that was 3 metres wide, still the wind would be strong enough to blow the rain against the windows under the veranda. It was a lovely spot. I do miss the sea. I used to drive down sometimes to the Esplanade to have some quiet time and just sit there and watch the ever-changing face of the sea. I do miss the sea. Although perhaps I should clarify that. Perhaps what I really miss is being at the edge of the sea, looking out at it. I'm not so sure that I'm all that keen on being in the middle of it, especially when those storms came in. For the Jews of Jesus' time, their image of the sea was one of chaos. They were not a sea-going nation. They did, of course, sail on the Sea of Galilee, on the lake. And those waters gave them food and livelihood. But their image of the sea was one of chaos. though he respected and feared the power of the sea. The Sea of Galilee, on which many of the disciples fish, was subject to sudden storms. Even the best weather forecasting skills would not be enough to warn the hapless sailors of the upheaval that was to come. And even the best sailing skills might not be enough to see them through the violence of the wind and the waves. For the people of the church to whom this story of Jesus, his disciples and the storm were told, this event would not just have been about quieting the wind and the sea and overcoming gravity, miraculous as that might be. It was also about entering into the chaos. We get some sense of this understanding of the sea representing chaos, chaos which is then transformed by the life-giving, creating force of God in the very opening verses of the biblical story. If we go back to the first chapter of Genesis. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. When the wind from God meets the chaos represented in the waters, creation begins. Life-giving things happen. The writers of the psalm use the image of the waters as a sign of great distress from which only God can rescue them. Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in deep mire where there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and the flood sweeps over me. From Psalm 107. For he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven. They went down to the depths. Their courage melted away in their calamity. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. The disciples were not just in the middle of a stormy sea, but in the middle of chaos, separated as they saw it from the presence of God as they had come to know it through Jesus. And then Jesus appears, walking on the sea, as previously only God is described as doing. Your way was through the sea, your path through the mighty waters. God is the one who stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea. As is to emphasise the divine presence, Jesus identifies himself in the same way that God identifies God's self to Moses. I am. Take heart. I am. Don't be afraid. And the disciples show their acceptance of the presence of God in the being and actions of this Jesus by responding in worship. Jesus brings God's creative force to the disciples, bringing life-giving power in the midst of chaos. And chaos is transformed into new possibilities. In a way, the story of Joseph is about that too. About the power of God to overcome the chaos that swirls around his family, the chaos of strained relationships, the chaos of arrogance, injustice and jealousy and murderous plotting. We only hear the beginning of the story here. But by the end of the story, Joseph is in Egypt in a position of power. And his dreams come true when his brothers come from a land of famine, seeking help for their family. When that happens, Joseph begins to see God's hand in all the events that have unfolded. He tells his brothers, "What you meant for evil, God has turned to good." The power of God's grace moves across the chaos that has been the context of Joseph's life for so many years. And rather than taking advantage of his brother's position, that movement of God's grace in the chaos of Joseph's life draws forth from Joseph life-giving forgiveness. Now, there may not be many of us here who've had the extreme experience of the sea as described in the story from Matthew. Have many of you been caught in a storm on the sea? You have? How was it? Frightening. Exciting. There's always some weird ones. It is a frightening experience. But even if we haven't been in that storm on the sea, I'm sure there are for most of us times that we can identify with that feeling of being threatened, even overwhelmed by chaos. It might be a chaos born out of suffering and sadness, a buffeting by the events of life that at times seem unendurable, beyond bearing. Or it may be a chaos constructed out of our own guilt, a distaste for what we have done or who we have become. It may be the chaos that results from uncertainty about the future, from being unable to see any way through the hopelessness in which we find ourselves. For some, the chaos is not just about our personal lives. It's seen in the wider creation. Fear for the sustainability of this planet, or despair at the overwhelming injustice of so few with so much and so many with so little. For Matthew's church, it may have spoken to the persecution which they face. Despite their obedience and faithfulness to the commands and commission of Jesus, their lives too at times seem chaotic, overwhelmed by a power they could not control. To them, this story speaks, as it does to us, that to be in the middle of chaos is not to be without the presence of the God we know in Jesus. However powerful the forces that seem to be battering us, they are nowhere near as strong as the power of God through Jesus to overcome and defeat those powers. But what do we make of Peter's response? Now, walking on water is one of those phrases that's generally entered our lexicon, the phrases that we use. It has a meaning beyond the biblical story, beyond the church life, and it is used in the wider world. If we think somebody's doing something remarkable, they've been walking on water. I think there's been some walking on water done around here, actually, just lately, to get those things happening in the hall. It's been a remarkable thing. We hear it. We hear reference to walking on water. I remember coming down from Port Augusta to the Festival of Arts and going to Memorial Drive tennis courts to see Jesus Christ Superstar. Remember the song in Jesus Christ Superstar, Herod's song? Prove to me, King Herod sings to Jesus, prove to me that you're no fool. Walk across my swimming pool. I remember seeing reference to walking on water for characters in various films. Do any of you remember seeing the film with Peter Sellers called Being There? No, it's a story about a very simple man who comes to have position of power through extraordinary ways. It's a very simple in many meanings of that word. And at the end, we see him walking across what we think is some wet ground. But right at the end, he takes his umbrella and he bends over and he tests the depths of the water with his umbrella. It says to us something about that character. It says to us that there's something special about that character. What do we make of Peter's response? Is this an example of how we should react in the middle of chaos? Is this story of Peter told to us to urge us to face the chaos with boldness and courage and faithfulness, and a little warning thrown in there of how we might falter if we're not careful? Well, I'm not so sure. Now, I am sure that Jesus calls us. I am sure that we are asked to live out the gospel faith in our lives with boldness and courage and faithfulness. And sometimes that means taking really brave steps. But I'm not so sure that that's what this story is about. You see, Peter's reply to Jesus reassuring, "I am," is not a response of faithfulness. It's a story of lack of faith. Jesus' response to Jesus is, "If it is you, if it is you." It's a response that asks for proof. A response that echoes the words of the tempter in the desert. "If you are the Son of God, turn these stones into bread." If it is you. If it is you who shows that you carry the very presence of God within you by walking on the water. If it is you, call me to come out the boat. Peter thinks that Jesus has been left behind on the beach, just as we might think that the power of Jesus' life has been left back in history. In either case, it can seem impossible to believe that Jesus is God with us, ready to transform the chaos in our lives. Perhaps the message we should hear about Peter's response is not if he had enough faith he could walk on water, any more than it is to us, if I have enough faith, my problems can be solved spectacularly. Surely faith is not about believing in spectacular exceptions to the way our world is fashioned. What if the message of the text is, if Peter had had enough faith, he would have believed those words of Jesus. "Take heart, I am." He would have believed that Jesus' presence meant that God was with them. Faith is not about being able to walk on water. That is divine activity, not human activity. Faith is about believing, sometimes in the face of a whole lot of evidence, that God is with us in the boat, that God is made real by the community called together by their faith in Jesus, that God is with us in the midst of chaos, even as we feel battered by the wind and tossed about by the waves. Yes, God calls us, and Jesus does call us even to acts of boldness and courage. And Jesus calls us also to the hard work of sharing and working together in faith in community. We follow Jesus best as we do so together, knowing the presence of God amongst us, not as we seek spectacular proof. What is your experience of chaos at the moment? Family matters? Health issues? Relationship conflicts? The reality of ageing? Is it dealing with the consequences of others' actions, or even living with the consequences of your own? God does not demand spectacular acts of us, but acts of courage that can be spectacular in the power of love. God comes to us with words of encouragement, offering to transform our chaos by moving through it and transforming it into new possibilities. God gives us a future, not a spectacularly miraculous one, but one we can face in the company of other faithful people, and one we can face in the power of God's Spirit.